Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. I'm excited to introduce two new authors, Sarah Hanks and Dr. Nancy Ross from Dixie State University. I'll let them introduce themselves more in a minute here, but they've written a book about the feminist Mormon housewives, 10 years of blogging. So it's going to be pretty interesting, and we're going to talk a little bit more about one of the major events there, Kate Kelly's excommunication and how it affected them. Check out our conversation. I'd also like to remind you, we've got our latest transcript up on Amazon now, and I've just sent it out to people who are monthly subscribers. So it's Daniel Stone's book on William Bickerton and our previous conversation there. So please check that out and please support Gospel Tangents. Become a monthly subscriber for just $10 a month, and you can get a transcript of Dr. Stone's interview, and as well as future interviews if you become a monthly subscriber. We'd also love to have one-time donations, so if you'd like to do that and you don't want a transcript, please help us out there. Also, please subscribe on Patreon if you'd like to see the whole interview of this coming interview. So check out our conversation. Well, welcome to Gospel Tangents Podcast. I'd like to have you guys both introduce yourself. Let's start with you.
So I'm Nancy Ross, and I am a professor at a university in Southern Utah.
And you can tell us the university.
The Dixie State University. Sure. And I'm an art historian by training, so I have a PhD in art history. But about a year ago, I changed departments into an interdisciplinary studies department. So because a lot of what I do these days with research and projects doesn't really focus around art history. It actually focuses more in Mormon studies. And so,
Oh, wow. So yeah,
I'm a medieval art historian who moonlights as a sociologist of religion, and I do a lot of Mormon studies stuff. So that's kind of what I do.
Well, that's fantastic. And tell us about yourself.
Yeah, my name's Sarah Hanks. I'm a mom of two, stay-at-home mom, freelance writer, part-time editorial assistant. I was born and raised in Utah and still live in Layton at this point. And I'm a former blogger at Feminist Mormon Housewives blog, which is how I got involved making this book about Feminist Mormon Housewives.
And why don't you show us your book?
So this is the book.
Where We Must Stand. All right.
Yeah, Where We Must Stand, 10 Years of Feminist Mormon Housewives.
Well, that's actually why we brought you on. You guys are both co-authors. So tell us a little bit about the book. What got you involved with that?
Yeah, so I began blogging. Feminist Mormon Housewives is a blog that's been around since 2004, group blog focusing on women's issues in the Mormon church, women's experiences and stories. And that blog began in 2004. I read it for a very long time. And in 2013, I was invited to come on as one of the bloggers. And 1 year later, in 2014, was the 10th anniversary. And it just seemed very momentous. Like, the blog has been around for 10 years. It's produced so much content. There's such a thriving community. It's been a very interesting 10 years. Like, there's been a complete story. And so I liked the idea of making a book about it and talked to my other bloggers, and they said, well, if you want to do that, we support you. I didn't know how to do it, but I figured I could figure it out. And so that was the starting point. And that was 4 years ago. So it took a long time to actually come to fruition. But that was my interest in it as a member of the community for a long time and one of the bloggers.
So how did you decide what to include? Because you didn't include every blog post.
No. There were over 4,000 blog posts published in those 10 years. It would have been, I mean, it could fill like an entire bookshelf if that was all in book form. So, I mean, it was a really painstaking process. The first part was just to read all of them. And any of them that stood out to me as particularly interesting or relevant or funny or well-written or whatever, I would just sort of make a note. I had this running list of blog posts that I thought might be good contenders. And by the end of that, I mean, I had hundreds of options. And so then we had to narrow it down and narrow it down. I had what I thought was going to be kind of like a final list. We were looking to publish the book in two volumes. And so there was room for a lot more, but then decided that we needed to have it in one volume. And that was when Nancy came on board about a year ago. And so she really helped look at that list that I thought we couldn't take anything away from, and we had to cut it down by, I think, more than half.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think when I first started, there were about 300,000 words of text, mm-hmm. and I think the book ended up at about 140,000 words mm-hmm. of text.
Yeah.
And so what we... Because, you know, it's like a paperback, right? The binding can only take so much stress.
Right, right.
So we figured we could have a really big book, but we couldn't have, like, a super size book. So what we did...
Not a Michael Quinn book.
No, love him, love his work.
Oh, obviously.
But you need a hardback for that, and we were trying to self-publish.
Yeah.
So,
okay. So, I mean, then we just took that list down by a lot. I think the final count of blog posts in the book is 136. Mm-hmm. And we tried to develop themes. We tried to say, okay, how did the community deal with, you know, this particular issue over time? We had to make some tough calls as far as, you know, here are lots of good posts on a certain subject, but mm-hmm. these ones are shorter, so we have to choose these, you know. And I mean, there were dozens of factors that went into deciding each thing. We wanted to make sure that different writers were represented appropriately. You know, if somebody contributed a lot of content to the blog over mm-hmm. the years, we wanted to make sure that that was reflected as well. And anyway.
So yeah, so ultimately after a couple of rounds, or after kind of I read everything that Sarah had, we decided that we were going to refine it down to a couple of really key themes that were really central to the blog over its first decade. And motherhood was one of those biggest of themes. You know, it really started, Lisa Patterson Butterworth founded the blog, and part of that was out of, like, the loneliness of being a young mother at home with young children. And so this theme of motherhood, and then the different ways in which people experience motherhood, you know, motherhood with disability, trying to become a mother but experiencing infertility.
Not wanting to be a mother.
Not wanting to be
a mother. As a Mormon woman, you know, that's a very, a strained place to be.
Yeah. And so we got a lot of, like, motherhood and motherhood-themed posts. We have, there are a number of posts that reference, like, Heavenly Mother. There are posts that reference modesty, like sexuality and modesty is a big and important theme that kind of runs throughout the book. Mm-hmm. Activism is an important theme that runs throughout the book. Yeah. And so we tried to be like, okay, well, what do we see as, like, these big themes from our experience? And then how do we kind of, you know, make the book flow because all the posts will be connected to kind of some common themes and threads.
I did notice that. I'm trying to remember what year it was when Kate Kelly got excommunicated.
2014.
Mm-hmm. That was a big theme for that entire year.
It dominated the landscape for sure.
But at that time, the community was all about activism, or so much of the community conversation turned to activism really... in the middle of 2012, and this is covered in the book, there's a little activist action to try and better understand different temples' policies with regard to, like, women and young women doing baptisms for the dead while menstruating. And so, you know, there are a bunch of phone calls are made, and they try to get information about what different temples' policies are, with the idea that, you know, you might show up at a temple and they might have a different policy, and that might make people feel excluded or
embarrassed.
Yeah. And so that happens in the middle of 2012. By the end of 2012, we've got the first Wear Pants to Church Day, and then that's followed by Let Women Pray and the Advent of Let Women Pray was its own activist event to try and ask church leaders to let a woman pray in general conference, which happened with Jean Stevens, which was super exciting.
Yeah.
And then we've got the arrival of ordained women in the spring of 2013. And so, like, leading up to Kate Kelly's excommunication, like, from the middle of 2012 to the middle of 2014, there was just so much momentum mm-hmm. in the community for, like, hey, we can change things. You know, with the temple baptisms issue, after all this information gathering, someone was able to kind of make a connection further up the chain in the church, and then the church issued a clarification.
Right.
So, like, to say, no, this is like, we need all temples to allow women to part and young women to participate in baptisms, regardless of whether or not they're menstruating. And that felt huge.
Oh yeah, because this whole time, I mean, that was like 8 years into FMH's existence, and sort of the rebuilding of the Mormon feminist community. And all that time, it had felt like we were having these very important conversations, but just with each other. We were like, I wonder if they even know we exist. Like, if the church as an organization, or you know, leaders, or the bureaucracy. And so that moment with the temple issue, it did really feel like, oh, like, we could have some impact. Like, even in these smaller areas, you know, what if we allowed ourselves to imagine that possibility instead of just thinking that this had to be a private matter? You know, what if we could be activists, basically?
And even just little tiny moments of acknowledgement were like just built up so much hope for change mm-hmm. in the community. And I remember feeling such intense hope for change. It's like, wow, this is such an exciting time to be a Mormon woman, because we are asking for things and those requests are being acknowledged and sometimes granted. And so when it was announced in advance of conference that like Jean Stevens was gonna pray, it felt like a huge moment of triumph.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And it's difficult to, right, like everything that's happened in the last few years, it's difficult to like revisit and kind of embody that moment of triumph because we all know that like that wasn't gonna last, right?
Yeah,
like
that
things weren't gonna play out in the way that we'd hoped.
That was the high watermark.
Right.
Yeah.
But it felt so good. It felt so hopeful. I felt very very secure. And when Kate Kelly was excommunicated, I was a Relief Society teacher, and I just felt not quite at that tense moment, but in the run up to a lot of that, I just felt like this is a great moment to be a Mormon woman, and I feel so hopeful that I can ask a question and that the church will hear me and that they will respond positively and try to make space for more people like me. And that just felt like a truly wonderful, hopeful thing after where that wasn't really the feeling I had had prior to that point. And so I mean, there was just that momentum for hope just really consumed the community, and it was a beautiful thing. Like, I know it wasn't gonna last, and things weren't gonna end the way we wanted them to. But those were truly great moments for the community to like come together to be like, we can affect change. Mm-hmm. And that was just a really great thing.
Yeah.
Well, great. So tell us what So with Kate Kelly, because that's really where the book kind of ends, it seems
yeah.
like.
Yeah, completely by coincidence, that was the 10-year mark.
Yeah.
And so you have this this high water mark where women can pray in conference, and you have the temple baptism issue that was taken care of. And then talk about the feelings when Kate Kelly was excommunicated.
Oh.
I mean, I think one part of the feeling was just so much shock. Because not only had we felt really hopeful for the possibilities of change, but we also kind of were under the impression as a community at large that with the advent of the internet and so much attention being paid to the church and so much possibility for exposing problems or injustices, that the church wouldn't take the sort of actions that they had taken when it came to Sonia Johnson in the 70s, or the September 6 in the early 90s, or the professors at BYU who were, you know, censured. Like, we thought they wouldn't, because it would be too much of a risk. Like, there would be too much backlash.
And it was also right in the middle of that Mormon moment, and the
yes.
church had done, with the I'm a Mormon campaign, had spent so much time, effort, energy, and resources trying to make the church look good in the eyes of the public.
Right.
So,
right.
like, with the Romney campaign, like, there was so much effort to try and, like, revamp the church as, like, modern and more inclusive
yeah.
than people maybe had guessed. And
there's room for everyone, and you know, and there were conference talks to that effect, you know, as mm-hmm. far as like, there is room for you here, I think is what Elder Ubdorf said, and mm-hmm. and we felt like there was, you know, I don't think there were very many supporters of ordained women or Mormon feminists who were expecting an announcement about women's ordination like any second, you know, there that wasn't the expectation. But for a year, ordained women had existed. Kate Kelly talks in the book, actually, there's a post, a guest post from her, where she talks about meeting with her bishop and how he wanted to make sure that she knew there was no danger of any disciplinary action, you know, and that she was welcomed. And there was this feeling that, like, okay, we're not going to get what we're asking for, but it's okay that we're asking, you know, and that's not a problem. And so, yeah, it just really came as a shock. I mean, so I think that was one element of the feeling at that time. There's a post in the book that I think of a lot from Joanna Brooks, and it was right after the announcement that both Kate Kelly and John DeLynn were going to be facing disciplinary action. That announcement came, like, both the announcement of both of those people facing discipline came on the same day, and so we were really grappling with it as a community. And Joanna writes about, the name of her post is "Let It Be Different This Time," that we, even after knowing that these courts were going to happen, there was still a little bit piece of our hearts that was like, well, maybe it'll be okay. Like, maybe some higher up will swoop in and fix it. So we were just shocked, I think.
Yeah, and that was definitely my feeling. You know, I had felt, you know, and I think a lot of us felt that the church was a much more moderate institution. Mm-hmm. And especially with things like the I'm a Mormon campaign, that it was trying to be a little more mainstream. Mm-hmm. and a little less exclusive,
right?
And it was a little less concerned with things like boundary maintenance. Mm-hmm. And of course we were wrong. We were wrong. Church was still very concerned with boundary maintenance, and it wasn't the more moderate institution that we felt it had become. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I was on that first board of ordained women, and I was in the room when Kate Kelly got the information from her bishop that she had been excommunicated, and it was devastating. And up until that moment, I had had this very firm belief, as Sarah just said, that, like, somebody was going to intervene and realize the harm that would be done to the church through this thing, and that they would put a stop to it.
Yeah.
Or put a stop to the idea that, like, you know, you can't still claim that it's okay for women to ask questions about women's issues and excommunicate Kate Kelly. Like, you can't claim on the one hand that that's okay, and then be excommunicating people for doing that exact same thing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, and that somebody would, like, you know, put a stop to the nonsense. But ultimately, what I discovered is that nobody was going to put a stop to that nonsense, and she was excommunicated, and that was such a shock to my system. I know that other people in that room and on that board at that time had a much greater sense of what was going to happen, and the church really hadn't changed, and that, you know, this was the most likely outcome. Mm-hmm. But for me and a few other people in that room, that was not. We had so much hope. And had so much tremendous hope that really made us naive to particular mm-hmm. realities of the church. And,
right.
And to say that it was devastating isn't quite strong enough mm-hmm. a term.
It really, I feel like for many people, it shifted their entire posture towards the church.
Yeah.
And towards being a woman and a feminist in a patriarchal institution. Mm-hmm. And another thing about it is that it wasn't simply about Kate, like, as a person. It was also about Kate as a symbol, as mm-hmm. like a representative of the community. But it was mm-hmm. also about the fact that dozens of other people who didn't have the name recognition that Kate had were experiencing discipline of their own. You know, there were some bishops who and stake presidents who felt emboldened by the high profile nature mm-hmm. of Kate's discipline to kind of clamp down on people in their own wards. Mm-hmm. And so in these Mormon feminist groups and communities, there was a lot of, you know, oh, did you hear about so-and-so? Like, she had her temple recommend taken away, or this person, mm-hmm. you know. And so it kind of felt like an onslaught of things happening and more disillusionment.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Nancy and Sarah. In our next conversation, we'll talk a little bit more about their Mormon journeys.
No, I am still very much a person of faith, even if my faith looks different from what it did that time. But Mormon feminists are people of faith. Sure, there are Mormon feminists who identify as atheists, and that's fine. But, like, the intense desire that the community had and what we tried to foster, or what FMH tried to foster, was like, here's how we can do this and make it work.
I hope you enjoyed that short clip from our next interview. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please go to our patreon.com/gospeltangents and subscribe for just $5 a month. If you'd like a transcript of this, please click the yellow subscribe button at gospeltangents.com, and I'll send you this and all future transcripts. Also, if you'd like a paperback like we've got here, those are available at our website at amazon.com. Just do a search for Gospel Tangents. Please get all updates at our Facebook page at facebook.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at Gospel Tangents. You can also get transcripts individually at our website, gospeltangents.com/shop. Finally, make sure that you subscribe on our Apple Podcast page. Just do a quick search for Gospel Tangents there and give us a 5-star review while you're at it. Thanks again for listening. Your support helps create more Mormon history classes and podcasts such as this, and so I really appreciate you listening. Please share with your friends. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our great videos. Thanks again.